Chapter 11. Margin announced a party and invited 40 people. The date for it was 7 days away. This was a fine opportunity. Margit's house stood by itself, and it could be easily watched. All the week it was watched night and day. Margit's household went out and in as usual, but they carried nothing in their hands, and neither they nor others brought anything to the house. This was ascertained. Evidently rations for 40 people were not being fetched. If they were furnished any sustenance, it would have to be made on the premises. It was true that Margit went out with a basket every evening, but the spies ascertained that she always brought it back empty. The guests arrived at noon and filled the place. Father Adolphe followed. Also, after a little, the astrologer, without invitation. The spies had informed him that neither at the back nor the front had any parcels been brought in. He entered, and found the eating and drinking going on finely, and everything progressing in a lively and festive way. He glanced around and perceived that many of the cooked delicacies, and all of the native and foreign fruits were of a perishable character, and he also recognized that these were fresh and perfect. No apparitions, no incantations, no thunder. That settled it. This was witchcraft. And not only that, but of a new kind, a kind never dreamed of before. It was a prodigious power, an illustrious power. He resolved to discover its secret. The announcement of it would resound throughout the world, penetrate to the remotest lands, paralyze all the nations with amazement, and carry his name with it, and make him renowned forever. It was a wonderful piece of luck, a splendid piece of luck. The glory of it made him dizzy. All the house made room for him. Margit politely seated him. Ursula ordered Gottfried to bring a special table for him. Then she decked it and furnished it, and asked for his orders. "Bring me what you will," he said. The two servants brought supplies from the pantry, together with white wine and red, a bottle of each. The astrologer, who very likely had never seen such delicacies before, poured out a beaker of red wine, drank it off, poured another, then began to eat with a grand appetite. I was not expecting Satan, for it was more than a week since I had seen or heard of him, but now he came in. I knew it by the feel, though people were in the way and I could not see him. I heard him apologizing for intruding, and he was going away, but Margit urged him to stay, and he thanked her and stayed. She brought him along, introducing him to the girls, and to Meadling, and to some of the elders, and there was quite a rustle of whispers: "It's the young stranger we hear so much about, and can't get sight of, he is away so much. Dear, dear, but he is beautiful. What is his name? P. Philip Traum. H., it fits him. You see, Traum is German for Rheim. What does he do? Studying for the ministry, they say. His face is his fortune, he'll be a cardinal someday. Here is his home? Way down somewhere in the tropics, they say, has a rich uncle down there." And so on. He made his way at once. Everybody was anxious to know him, and talk with him. Everybody noticed how cool and fresh it was, all of a sudden, and wondered at it, for they could see that the sun was beating down the same as before, outside, and the sky was clear of clouds. But no one guessed the reason, of course. The astrologer had drunk his second beaker. He poured out a third. He set the bottle down, and by accident overturned it. He seized it before much was spilled, and held it up to the light, saying, "What a pity it is royal wine." Then his face lighted with joy or triumph, or something, and he said, "Quick, bring a bowl." It was brought, a 4-quart one. He took up that 2-pint bottle, and began to pour, went on pouring, the red liquor gurgling and gushing into the white bowl and rising higher and higher up its sides, everybody staring and holding their breath, and presently the bowl was full to the brim. "Look at the bottle," he said, holding it up. "It is full yet." I glanced at Satan, and in that moment he vanished. Then Father Adolphe rose up, flushed and excited, crossed himself, and began to thunder in his great voice, "This house is bewitched and accursed. People began to cry and shriek and crowd toward the door. Some in his detected household, his words were cut off short. His face became red, then purple, but he could not utter another sound. Then I saw Satan, a transparent film, melt into the astrologer's body. Then the astrologer put up his hand, and apparently in his own voice said, "Wait, remain where you are." All stopped where they stood. Bring a funnel. Ursula brought it, trembling and scared, and he stuck it in the bottle, and took up the great bowl, and began to pour the wine back, the people gazing, and dazed with astonishment, for they knew the bottle was already full before he began. He emptied the whole of the bowl into the bottle, then smiled out over the room, chuckled, and said, "Indifferently, colon, it is nothing, anybody can do it. With my powers I can even do much more." A frightened cry burst out everywhere. "H, my God, he is possessed," and there was a tumultuous rush for the door which swiftly emptied the house of all who did not belong in it except us boys and Meadling. We boys knew the secret, and would have told it if we could, but we couldn't. We were very thankful to Satan for furnishing that good help at the needful time. Margit was pale and crying. Meadling looked kind of petrified. Ursula the same, but Gottfried was the worst. He couldn't stand, he was so weak and scared. For he was of a witch family, you know, and it would be bad for him to be suspected. Agnes came loafing in, looking pious and unaware, and wanted to rub up against Ursula and be petted, but Ursula was afraid of her, and shrank away from her, but pretending she was not meaning any incivility, for she knew very well it wouldn't answer to have strained relations with that kind of a cat. But we boys took Agnes and petted her, for Satan would not have befriended her if he had not had a good opinion of her, and that was inducement enough for us. He seemed to trust anything that hadn't the moral sense. Outside, the guests, panic-stricken, scattered in every direction and fled in a pitiable state of terror, and such a tumult as they made with their running and sobbing and shrieking and shouting, that soon all the village came flocking from their houses to see what had happened, and they thronged the street and shouldered and jostled one another in excitement and fright. And then Father Adolf appeared, and they fell apart in two walls like the cloven Red Sea, and presently down this lane the astrologer came striding and mumbling, and where he passed the lane surged back in packed masses, and fell silent with awe, and their eyes stared and their breasts heaved, and several women fainted, and when he was gone by the crowd swarmed together, and followed him at a distance, talking excitedly and asking questions and finding out the facts. Finding out the facts and passing them on to others, with improvements which soon enlarged the bowl of wine to a barrel, and made the one bottle hold it all, and yet remain empty to the last. When the astrologer reached the market square he went straight to a juggler, fantastically dressed, who was keeping three brass balls in the air, and took them from him, and faced around upon the approaching crowd, and said, "Colon, this poor clown is ignorant of his art. Come forward and see an expert perform." So saying, he tossed the balls up one after another, and set them whirling in a slender bright oval in the air, and added another, then another and another, and soon, no one seeing whence he got them, adding, the oval lengthening all the time, his hands moving so swiftly that they were just a web or a blur, and not distinguishable as hands, and such as counted said there were now 100 balls in the air. The spinning great oval reached up 20 feet in the air, and was a shining and glinting and wonderful sight. Then he folded his arms, and told the balls to go on spinning without his help, and they did it. After a couple of minutes he said, "There, that will do," and the oval broke and came crashing down, and the balls scattered abroad, and rolled everywhither. And wherever one of them came the people fell back in dread, and no one would touch it. It made him laugh, and he scoffed at the people, and called them cowards and old women. Then he turned, and saw the tight rope, and said foolish people were daily wasting their money to see a clumsy and ignorant varlet degrade that beautiful art. Now they should see the work of a master. With that he made a spring into the air, and lit firm on his feet on the rope. Then he hopped the whole length of it back and forth on one foot, with his hands clasped over his eyes. And next he began to throw somersaults, both backward and forward, and threw 27. The people murmured, for the astrologer was old, and always before had been halting of movement, and at times even lame, but he was nimble enough now, and went on with his antics, in the liveliest manner. Finally he sprang lightly down and walked away, and passed up the road, and around the corner and disappeared. Then that great, pale, silent, solid crowd drew a deep breath, and looked into one another's faces, as if they said, "Was it real? Did you see it, or was it only I and was I dreaming?" Then they broke into a low murmur of talking, and fell apart in couples, and moved toward their homes, still talking in that odd way, with faces close together, and laying a hand on an arm, and making other such gestures as people make, when they have been deeply impressed by something. We boys followed behind our fathers, and listened, catching all we could of what they said. And when they sat down in our house, and continued their talk, they still had us for company. They were in a sad mood, for it was certain, they said, that disaster for the village must follow this awful visitation of witches and devils. Then my father remembered that Father Adolf had been struck dumb at the moment of his denunciation. "They have not ventured to lay their hands upon an anointed servant of God before," he said. "And how they could have dared at this time I cannot make out, for he wore his crucifix. Isn't it so?" "Yes," said the others, "we saw it." "It is serious, friends, it is very serious. Always before, we had a protection. It has failed." The others shook, as with a sort of chill, and muttered those words over -- "it has failed. God has forsaken us." "It is true," said Seppi Wohlmeyer's father. "There is nowhere to look for help." "The people will realize this," said Nicholas's father, the judge, "and despair will take away their courage and their energies. We have indeed fallen upon evil times." He sighed, and Wohlmeyer said, in a troubled voice, "The report of it all will go about the country, and our village will be shunned as being under the displeasure of God. The golden stag will know hard times." "True, neighbor," said my father. "All of us will suffer, all in repute, many in the state. And, good God, what is it that can come to finish us? Name it, God's willin." The interdict. It smote like a thunderclap, and they were like to swoon with the terror of it. Then the dread of this calamity roused their energies, and they stopped brooding, and began to consider ways to avert it. They discussed this, that, and the other way, and talked till the afternoon was far spent, then confessed that at present they could arrive at no decision. So they parted sorrowfully, with oppressed hearts which were filled with bodings. While they were saying their parting words, I slipped out, and set my course for Marget's house to see what was happening there. I met many people, but none of them greeted me. It ought to have been surprising, but it was not, for they were so distraught with fear and dread, that they were not in their right minds, I think. They were white and haggard, and walked like persons in a dream, their eyes open but seeing nothing, their lips moving but uttering nothing, and worriedly clasping and unclasping their hands without knowing it. At Marget's it was like a funeral. She and Wilhelm sat together on the sofa, but said nothing, and not even holding hands. Both were steeped in gloom, and Marget's eyes were red from the crying as he had been doing. She said, "I have been begging him to go, and come no more, and so save himself alive. I cannot bear to be his murderer. This house is bewitched, and no inmate will escape the fire. But he will not go, and he will be lost with the rest." Wilhelm said he would not go. If there was danger for her, his place was by her, and there he would remain. Then she began to cry again, and it was all so mournful that I wished I had stayed away. There was a knock now, and Satan came in, fresh and cheery and beautiful, and brought that whiny atmosphere of his, and changed the whole thing. He never said a word about what had been happening, nor about the awful fears which were freezing the blood in the hearts of the community, but began to talk and rattle on about all manner of gay and pleasant things, and next about music, an artful stroke which cleared away the remnant of Marget's depression, and brought her spirits and her interests broad awake. She had not heard anyone talk so well and so knowingly on that subject before, and she was so uplifted by it, and so charmed, that what she was feeling lit up her face, and came out in her words, and Wilhelm noticed it, and did not look as pleased as he ought to have done. And next Satan branched off into poetry, and recited some, and did it well, and Marget was charmed again. And again Wilhelm was not as pleased as he ought to have been, and this time Marget noticed it and was remorseful. I fell asleep to pleasant music, that night the patter of rain upon the panes, and the dull growling of distant thunder. Away in the night Satan came and roused me, and said, Colin, come with me. Where shall we go? Anywhere so it is with you. Then there was a fierce glare of sunlight, and he said, This is China. That was a grand surprise, and made me sort of drunk with vanity and gladness, to think I had come so far so much, much farther than anybody else in our village, including Bartle Sperling, who had such a great opinion of his travels. We buzzed around over that empire for more than half an hour, and saw the whole of it. It was wonderful, the spectacles we saw, and some were beautiful, others too horrible to think. For instance, however, I may go into that by and by, and also why Satan chose China for this excursion instead of another place. It would interrupt my tale to do it now. Finally we stopped flitting and lit. We sat upon a mountain commanding a vast landscape of mountain range and gorge and valley and plain and river, with cities and villages slumbering in the sunlight, and a glimpse of blue sea on the farther verge. It was a tranquil and dreamy picture, beautiful to the eye and restful to the spirit. If we could only make a change like that whenever we wanted to, the world would be easier to live in than it is, for change of scene shifts the mind's burdens to the other shoulder and banishes old, shop-worn wearinesses from mind and body both. We talked together, and I had the idea of trying to reform Satan, and persuade him to lead a better life. I told him about all those things he had been doing, and begged him to be more considerate, and stop making people unhappy. I said I knew he did not mean any harm, but that he ought to stop and consider the possible consequences of a thing, before launching it in that impulsive and random way of his. Then he would not make so much trouble. He was not hurt by this plain speech. He only looked amused and surprised, and said, What? I do random things? Indeed, I never do. I stop and consider possible consequences. Where is the need? I know what the consequences are going to be always. Oh, Satan, then how could you do these things? Well, I will tell you, and you must understand if you can. You belong to a singular race. Every man is a suffering machine, and a happiness-machine combined. The two functions work together harmoniously, with a fine and delicate precision, on the give-and-take principle. For every happiness turned out in the one department, the other stands ready to modify it with a sorrow, or a pain, maybe a dozen. In most cases the man's life is about equally divided between happiness and unhappiness. When this is not the case, the unhappiness predominates always, never the other. Sometimes a man's make and disposition are such, that his misery- Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.